Hi, everyone. We're back.
Hello.
Hi there. So just to let everyone know, this is February the 5th, and this is, of course, our weekly Climate Literacy Network call. And I'm Scott Carley, Director of Exploration. And just as we usually start, I'm curious whether there are any announcements that folks would like to make.
Scott, this is Frank. I think in the near days away, the Clean team will be posting the new gap analysis for climate and energy literacy. So the first time they've done energy literacy.
Yes.
And then on top of that, we'll be adding the topical climate energy topics mapping, but we'll be doing that a little bit differently. But there's some really rich and interesting work there.
Hmm. Oh, excellent. Frank, I was just going to say, Frank, my understanding is that you are going to maybe talk a little bit about, I guess it's clean.gov and sort of this, climate.gov and sort of the relationship with clean. Would that be a good time to also talk about some of these mappings and things?
It's part of the, the best way to think about it is the post-NSF phase work that Clean's doing, and there's a series of things that are all kind of happening simultaneously, so it'd probably be best to characterize them together.
Yeah, hopefully.
Are we talking about that today, or are we doing that sometime in the future?
Maybe we could talk a little bit about it today if you want to and others are interested, or we can leave that to a full session where we just sort of focus on, said, it's post-NSF work that Clean's doing.
Cool.
Yeah, well, I think probably sometime in March, I'm guessing, at least the earliest. Unless people want to talk about it.
Okay.
So before we get into whatever our discussion is, are there any other announcements from folks? Things coming up?
Right.
I must admit, I'm not hearing too much of that. Someone have a comment they wanted to make? So any announcements for what Frank said?
Martha, and I'm on the call, but I'm on mute, so I'm listening.
Okay. Yeah, we seem to be getting something quite garbled, and I'm not sure whether that's just rustling papers or we're getting some serious technical gobbles. Okay.
Scott, hearing a little quiet, I was wondering if There's a subtopic that I think Mark is doing right now that is a little bit timely that I'm wondering. Mark is probably not on the line. He's usually not able to join us anymore.
Right.
But the National Climate Assessment piece, he's working on doing the public comments on that. And one of the things, and maybe this is better done through the listserv, but maybe we can frame it here and see if it's worthy of going to the listserv, is, in the National Climate Assessment through the U.S. Global Change Research Program, there is a focus on something called sustained assessments, meaning you don't spin something up and then 4 years later you spin a new thing up. It's some of the science you need to keep on doing steadily. And there's a section on, decision support or decision making. As usual, the idea of education is missing in their thinking. So social sciences is there, communication is there, but education is completely missing.
Uh-huh.
And The question is, is anybody aware of any research that clearly connects, you know, educational initiatives that actually improve decision making within the context of, you know, if it's global or climate change issues, that's probably pushing it. But just, you know, it, you know, making a evidence-based or research-based case for that piece of work in the work of decision support, decision makers needing, you know, a more educated citizenry in order to make the decisions they have to make within the context of climate and global change. It's you know, I just, you know, because if we can make a stronger case, I think we can cite those papers and make a stronger argument.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody have anything that rings any bells?
So you're asking, Frank, hi, this is Kristen.
Hey, Kristen.
Asking for ed research that shows a link between an actual initiative, an education initiative, and decision-making, sound decision-making related to good energy choices or good things that are related to global change?
I wouldn't bound it to an initiative, per se, because, you know, a lot of the stuff we do is aggregated together. Well, no, it's more just, you know, education, the whole, so, you know, there are currently approximately 74 million students in the nation right now, all the way up through doctoral level. So that's a sizable percentage of the population that are currently in formal education. Leaving informal out for a second, without meaning to, you know, just, you know, not make it important. It's incredibly important.
Mm-hmm.
But the role of education in, you know, preparing citizens to work with challenging issues, that decision makers are having to make decisions and establish policies and, you know, move out on. But there doesn't seem to be any, you know, appreciation of the role of education as a system, formal and informal or formal by itself, in that space with regard to its constituents. Is that a little bit clearer? Not just like one initiative. I'm talking the aggregate.
So, Frank, this is Scott. Do you think that part of this is that the education system is largely focused on sort of skill building and content development rather than decision making? I mean, that's not normally something that we infuse our classes with in a real direct sense. That maybe that's not so true, though. I say it, and I'm not sure if I really believe that.
Yeah. Well, but you know, I'm with you, Scott. But
yeah.
I think the you're right that historically we've not done that. That's one thing. I think that we're probably in the next generation science standards, and as time progresses, that's going to change. But having a skillful and knowledgeable conversation about a problem,
right,
is. Or even understanding the scientific process relative to identifying and concluding it's a problem. I would think that decision makers can work with their constituents if they are more not. I mean, that's maybe the hypothesis here. Does a more educated citizenry allow a decision maker to make different decisions that are more in line with the science?
Well, when you say that, I think of the comments the NSTA made around the first draft of the Next Generation Science Standards, and that was that there wasn't a lot of material on the nature of science. And maybe the incorporation of that, and I don't know how you feel about it, but I wasn't particularly overwhelmed with how it was in the second draft, but it is there. Maybe that's a part of moving us to a point where education actually really is providing the basis for citizens and decision-making and, you know, voting and, you know, supporting various kinds of efforts. Is that a piece of the Next Generation Science Standards that really sort of points us in that direction, or do you really see that there's other things that we really need to focus on as we implement the Next Generation Science Standards?
So it's Gail Sinatra's work. I can't remember her collaborator. some of, I mean, she's presented at AGU as part of the climate literacy sessions. I mean, one of the, some of her body of work say that the, you know, if you teach climate, students actually understand it more. Seems a pretty simple statement. But then further, if they are given time on the topic and they are more knowledgeable about it, they are more concerned about it when they actually understand what it, the findings are. But then that, does that also equate to improving the decision space decision makers are in?
Right.
Maybe there's a logic without a research conclusion to it, but there's some logic there. That's what I'm kind of throwing around.
Yeah. So there's a bit of a disconnect there in some ways.
Does anybody else have any, I mean, is any other thoughts on the subject?
No, I mean, that's a tough topic. I don't know of any research body on that. I mean, there's the whole issue that U.S. educational policy is pretty, at least up until having the consistent standards, has been pretty sporadic, so stuff has been different state to state, and it's really been, there's one article we cite, but I think it's only indirectly related to what you're mentioning, this idea of activity mania, especially in the elementary and middle schools, where this activity, then this activity, then this activity, without an overarching theme to connect it so the students don't understand and them not really getting a deep understanding because it's just jumping from activity to activity. But I don't think that feeds directly into how does that affect their parents or their policymakers or anything like that.
Yeah.
There is some research, at least in the, I think, informal learning environment where students going home and learning content that is substantially inconsistent with the beliefs of their parents puts this kid in like a cognitive dissonance, which can be very uncomfortable for them to reach consensus on. So in like physics, it's maybe not an issue because their parents aren't going to bring up physics at home and it can get resolved. Right. If it's their parents advocating for something that's radically different than what they're learning at school, the kid typically gets thrown into this state of flux and oftentimes will identify with what their parents believe.
Right. So maybe one way of looking at that is that it actually improvements. I mean, there's going to have to be some leaps of logic here. But the improvements in the education system with regard to issues that we're talking about, and I think we as a community say that climate is going to be a very large issue over the coming generations and coming decades, will ease that space as opposed to it already is improving. Maybe you can do the inverse. Does that jive?
I mean, yeah, it seems logical that it's going to be a much bigger topic in day-to-day conversation and with families as the impact of it. They see it on a more of a day-to-day basis.
Right.
So would it be advisable for, I don't know what the timeline on the National Climate Assessment is, but for Mark to kind of present his kind of like we did with the Next Generation Science Standards, his conclusions that probably NCSEs are going to put in, and then, you know, the letter from the network that is kind of built off of NCSEs that kind of adds those argument structures. Would that be something the network would be open to? I mean, I realize we're only talking to a subset here.
Well, we certainly, and we haven't had a talk from Mark for a while, and this is extraordinarily important, so I certainly can ask him how we could be useful, actually, to their work.
I think anything that document seems to speak to kind of a long-term sustained effort on something, so I think that's maybe the one thing our education system hasn't done well, so to be on board with that and to say, here's the body of knowledge we have now, but this has to be iteratively improved and it has to meet the cognitive demands of the students, I think would be critically important. I think some of the challenges we're facing is just because of the, not just climate literacy, but just nature of science literacy, which there isn't a lot of research into. So I think getting that statement put in there and getting it acknowledged that the education system needs to be seen as the same way. That's the thing that's going to change, and I think it's going to be much easier to facilitate with national standards, because as we think about our own local initiatives, everything's going to be scaled up, going to be possibly scaled up at some point to a larger audience.
That's an interesting. So would it be fair to say, is the scientific understanding relative to decision space improves, the public understanding that education plays a key role, if continues to reform in these directions, would be complementary?
Yes.
To those initiatives.
Yes. Both our content knowledge and our understanding of human decision-making. Because I think the behavioral sciences research into why humans behave the way they are with climate change is growing as well.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, in many ways, that's the way I've characterized this within that community. But it's a hard sell, guys. And I think anything we can do to help them value and appreciate the subtleties of what we bring to the equation would be most welcome.
I think it also starts to acknowledge some of the science behind learning, which has the potential to elevate that profession. And I know teachers in Ohio are feeling really demoralized right now as their knowledge of what happens in the classroom is beaten up a bit. And I think as a scientific community, we can help buffer that and help maybe elevate that profession so that we don't lose a lot of our quality people over the next decade and maybe, you know, attract other quality candidates to come into teaching profession. Maybe helping that audience understand the critical role they're going to play to bridge the gap between the public and the science community.
It would probably be good if our as we're continuing to have this conversation to bring in, say, the leaders in the informal science community and how that complements what we're talking about that's principally currently in the conversation now, formal.
Yeah.
And you know, how do these things work together? Because if you couple the formal system and the informal system, you're talking a huge enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Informal education probably has somewhere in the excess of 400 million visitors a year in the United States.
Yeah.
Maybe 500 million, somewhere in that range. And, you know, the contact time of formal education, you know, could be upwards of 20 years with, you know, 180 contact hours in one discipline, somewhere in that range.
Mm-hmm.
That's no small enterprise. But, anyway. I think I'm preaching to the converted here.
Frank, you talked a little bit about the social science there. Has there really been any movement to create a set of standards around social science? I mean, we've certainly talked about that, but I haven't gotten the sense that it really is connected with any group that wants to create a similar document to what we've done.
You know what, Scott, I think the closest to that is probably the geography standards.
Yeah.
I would think that I've heard the social sciences have kind of, you know, intimated at things, but it's never really gotten anywhere.
Yeah.
Especially in the context of issues that we talk about usually. But
right.
the geography space, the cultural geography, does connect here strongly, but, you know, we haven't, I'm not clear where the national geography standards are right now.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I just wonder whether that's something that we should try to do, is to make some connection, especially with the geographers, or at least initially with the geographers, to sort of also encourage them to, you know, have the same kind of conversations that we do. Maybe that would be useful.
There's another connection, too. There's the Common Core, so not the Next Gen Science, but the Common Core for English and Math.
Yep.
The English Language Arts section at the back has an appendix called Standards for Literacy and History, Social Studies, Science, and Technical Subjects. And it's only about 6 pages, but a lot of that talks about reasoning, explanations, interpreting an author's standpoint, view, background. And those things are in there to try to look at how those other subjects can reinforce critical thinking skills in the field. Some of that stuff speaks directly to how the scientific enterprise works.
Mm-hmm.
It's only 6 pages, but it actually has a lot of connections that thread throughout the curriculum, so that might be something else that kind of reinforces this idea of critical thinking in science, but it bridges all disciplines because it'll connect the two.
But there's another piece of that when I talk to librarians and English teachers,
mm-hmm.
the one piece of the climate literacy guide that we inserted that other literacies didn't pick up was the ability to you know, critically assess scientific information for credibility.
Yeah.
It's part of the definition. It doesn't really show up in the documents, in the concepts very much. It's kind of a meta thing. But when you think about that in the context of a school, the person who generally does that work is a librarian or an English teacher, more so than a science teacher or a math teacher. And so that skill, if you put it that way, is critical to the work that we do. Yeah. If you look at the national dialogue and how unsophisticated they are about that exact issue.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there it is. So I absolutely echo what you just said.
Yeah. Frank, I'm literally working with a group right now that we're revising the ocean literacy document. I mean, we're literally doing it this week, sort of the final touches. That's not something that we put sort of into the ocean stuff because it wasn't there in the original. Do you think it would be helpful to add that sort of fourth element of, what a ocean literate citizen needs?
So, Scott, I mean, there are two pieces to it. There's that definitional addition that we added that earth science, which came after us, and atmospheric science came after us, didn't include.
No, they didn't include.
Energy didn't either.
Yep.
Now, I mean, they may have, I think energy may have done something else. But the other piece of that is there are two other aspects of climate. I mean, there's another aspect of climate that we put in that the others hadn't, which was the guiding principle. And then energy added the teaching principle.
That's right.
So, I mean, ocean, I think ocean should take a look at, because if you the reason we put the guiding principle in is because the last item in the definition that ocean literacy started with was able to make informed and responsible decisions regarding blah. Fill in the topic of the day, right? So in this case, I can't remember exactly how Ocean says it, but when our community took a look at that part of the definition, the social scientists in the climate community started smacking us around and like, if you're just knowledgeable about all these main science topics, you're not going to actually get the definition done unless you have this guiding principle work. So I think a challenge to you guys is to look at what is the guiding principle for making decisions related to the ocean that is, ocean specific.
Right. And I can tell you that we've talked about putting, the energy literacy principle around teaching in there. We're thinking we would just put the whole thing back, right in ours also, out of the framework as a kind of introduction into the next generation science standards. But this is, it's interesting to suggest bringing the, the climate literacy guiding principle into.
Well, right, but I think you would have to modify the principle and the concepts for ocean specifics. But as I think many criticisms of the ocean literacy is there's no problem that oceans are facing in the concepts and principles as they're originally set. So there's no motive. Why should you be ocean literate now?
Right. And we've
in climate,
done
we did
quite
that.
A bit of, I think, improvement. I mean, actually, I think people will be a little bit surprised how much we're actually changing. And part of it is because we went through a process of working on the scope and sequence, so we have material there that we're bringing forward to be, on this higher level with the concepts and principles. The reason for bringing this up is that this has become another mechanism about bringing these ideas and having them, someplace else in these documents that we've used. And I was Jason, your comment around the Common Core pieces is really important because we can strengthen that in discussion of the next generation science standards because of the linkage to the Common Core stuff. So, that's kind of interesting. And then what I was mentioning about the nature science elements, too. Yeah.
Who mentioned the Common Core piece? I don't recognize your voice.
Jason Cervenek.
Hey, Jason.
How's it going?
Six pages.
If you could send that, that would be...
I have the document right here.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah. because I, you know, I speak for myself, I actually haven't gone that far into the to those standards or the Common Core standards.
Yeah, and just flip to the back. It's the last six is really, I mean, the rest of it goes into a lot of narrative stuff and literature in general, but the last section is very concise. And I think for a lot of teachers we're interacting with, they want good ways to address this, mm-hmm. Those standards. And a lot of the science teachers, a lot of the content teachers for ELA want stuff that they can bring from other topics into their classes, and the science teachers want good examples of things, a lot of primary source readings.
Definitely.
That help build science skills, but they don't have the time to go out and try to peruse all the literature body for good examples to put kids through, where they
right.
see a lot. I mean, just teaching the basic fact of, well, what's the background of this author? What perspective do they come to? Is this person an authority figure you could trust? I think if students understood that well, if they didn't understand a lot of other facets of climate, they would at least realize, well, who's the person speaking on the TV and what's their background, and should I listen to this voice as an authority or not?
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly.
Well, this, you know, sort of opens up that whole notion that as we sort of move through the next generation science standards adoption and implementation, that if we could start to bring these elements that are already existing in the document, whether it's the literacy frameworks or the Common Core, we could be talking exactly about those issues that you raised initially, Frank, around critical thinking and decision making, and we could make that maybe even a stronger piece just by, you know, referencing all this existing material.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know, I think I would highly advise bringing forward the teaching principle. Because it's topic it's independent in that space, and I think that the Common Core piece that Jason mentioned is because those Common Core connections, while they weren't in the second draft, they said to be determined or whatever to be added,
yeah,
or,
right. Not in
but
the
I mean they're there. They just didn't put them in the final artwork.
Right.
And I think that the you know I would say within the context of formal education, climate literacy, ocean literacy. You know, for the states that, you know, where they have NGSS, and they're, you know, Karen's piece said it's going to be, could be as much as 30 states, you know, that's going to be the front, and the climate literacy is and ocean literacy and energy literacy are really frameworks to support the next generation science standards, not the lead.
Yeah.
Maybe an informal will still be useful, you know, more broadly or undergraduate, but, you know, we're going to have to be lining up behind this next gen stuff. And then connecting it to the Common Core makes a hell of a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I'm just kind of wondering whether there's, you know, a think piece or, you know, a white paper that we might want to create collectively that sort of shows how that all those pieces work together.
Yeah, I think
yeah.
that's a brilliant idea. And
yeah.
in that space, adding the geography.
Yeah.
You know, especially the cultural geography side. I mean, that's really where I think, you know, and Danny Edelson has been, you know, key in that, and Next Gen and National Geographic have been doing tons of, you know, tracking and working on the next generation science standards from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's a lot of natural work there.
Yeah.
But I like that. I like that idea.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of middle school teachers interested in stuff that bridges the sciences with geography in social studies.
Yep.
Because there's so much, especially with climate change, there's so much of a connection. A lot of our researchers are in South America or the Himalayas, and it's easy to connect. Well,
mm-hmm.
here's the change they're seeing, the effect on the local agriculture, the access that people have to water. Students seem to connect with that, and then they listen to the science afterwards because there's a face on it.
Well, another thing, just historically, the development of things like the ocean literacy that begat all the other literacies, it actually came out of a program in National Geographic, and that was simply look at the relationship of oceans to geography. So Oceans for Life, which is the document that preceded the ocean literacy things, it was deeply part of geography. So it's absolutely natural for us to be linking that together just sort of from a... you know, sort of an organizational perspective. Obviously, you just said that it's so easy to teach in the context of geography, too.
So another piece of that is when in my time at NASA, the you know, trying to get Earth System Science into high school science or middle school science was a really hard thing. But eventually we started moving into the geography education, which is much more in the middle school level.
Yes.
And it was smooth like butter. It was so easy. And it was a very natural fit. And so, you know, now that Earth Systems is solidly in that next generation science standards, I mean, for us not to connect to the geography community is really
right.
foolish.
Right.
I don't know why everything's smooth like butter these days. Maybe it's wintertime.
Whatever.
Maybe I need to lay off the butter. So, but I mean, Scott, I think this raises a, there was a posting that I shared. There's a journal that is currently looking for submissions on climate literacy. I don't know if anybody remembers
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a message that came through, I think, this week, and a reminder on that.
Yeah. I think if we looked at possibly, you know, like I need more work like a hole in the head, but I think, you know,
exactly.
a good thought piece is what the requirements are, but a good thought piece would be fine.
Yeah. Well, it's so critical, and it's so easy for people to miss the relationships to some of the documents and the work that's already been done. And maybe even just going back to your original point, Frank, is that if we could make those connections in the documents, it might also encourage folks to do research and seeing how effective using each of those documents or those approaches comes to enhancing the quality of decision-making.
Hey, Scott,
I measure that kind of stuff, so that would be interesting in its own right.
Michael Weiss, am I saying Michael Weiss Session? Is that right? While ago, he's part of the lead for the Earth Space writing team for NGSS.
Yep, absolutely.
And
John was a part of that team, too. Yep.
Right, and I think he was writing a paper about how the standards and the literacy frameworks kind of work together.
Okay.
So maybe one of us should reach out to Michael and just see, because he actually asked me for how do I cite the climate literacy and, you know, give me an official image. And
right.
I gave him that, but it might be valuable just to kind of see. He's probably done a lot of intellectual thought on this space recently.
Yep. Well, and again, it suggests a possible presentation here, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I don't even know whether Michael's actually talked with this group at all. I can't remember us scheduling that.
Yeah, Scott, you take some of the point on that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you mind reaching out to Michael and just seeing kind of if he wouldn't mind engaging us and maybe we can see if we could, I don't know how long that paper is.
So you think he's already finished that paper?
Well, he wrote a paper. How related it is to the work, you know, what percentage of new intellectual thought would be in the new paper is another question. But I think, you know, leveraging and connecting and, you know, building from is I guess where I was going.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's great. Yeah, both Tamara and I know Michael, so that's an easy ask.
Hmm.
Oh, this is good. Interesting stuff. So how are we doing on time?
Well, we got about another 20 minutes. Can I ask Kristen a question?
Absolutely. Please.
Kristen, you off mute?
Out there.
All right. Hey, any scuttlebutt on Minnesota and NGSS?
What do you mean scuttlebutt?
Well, I mean, are they still looking favorable to adoption and implementation?
But I think I brought up last week, we don't adopt because of our legal system until 2018.
18.
Which is when the next science standards are officially adopted.
Right.
But they are, I was talking about it last week. John Olson is our department, our science specialist for the Department of Ed, and working with Achieve on the standard stuff. And he's been doing a huge amount of outreach into just the community in Minnesota about the next generation standards, doing professional development, taking out sort of pieces of it. Mostly, I mean, getting more into the practice, I think. Our standards are, I mean, probably more closely aligned with NGSS than maybe other states, I would say. I mean, they're definitely not there, but there's definitely more in them than you will find in other states. So he's been doing professional development workshops with teachers about different pieces of it. And I know that from my perspective, last time I talked to him, it seemed like it wouldn't be a big deal once adoption came around that they would be adopting them. It just, it won't be official for another 5 years.
Well, but actually the reason I asked you that was that doesn't mean that there won't be any work to support educators and all the pieces of support.
Mm-hmm.
Professional development, in-service, pre-service, curriculum materials, assessment, all that stuff during that 5 years.
Right.
You know, because...
From our perspective, the professional development work that we do, I mean, we're on it, and we're looking at them, and we're trying to figure out how we'll be taking out which pieces. I get really excited about the practice of science part of these standards. Just because our, you know, approach to climate change ed is very interdisciplinary, and that's exactly what is going on with these standards, which is really exciting. So we'll be definitely supporting that. And it is a conversation I'd like to have with John, just how we can support him, and if there are certain pieces of it that we can help him with as well. I mean, he's really supportive of our work and shares it with teachers in the state as well. So it's kind of we've got a two-way, very open
right.
conversation with him.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did that answer? Was that helpful?
Yeah, I guess where I'm getting at is it's almost like the implementation adoption model
mm-hmm.
for, like, looking at, you know, all the stuff that has to happen before you actually officially legislatively say yes.
Right.
That it doesn't mean we're doing nothing or we're using the old system solidly until the new system or anything like that. It's a much more fluid space.
It seems real. I mean, 5 years isn't actually that long. And from what I can tell so far, it feels very much like what you're saying, that it's sort of will be gradually easing in and it won't be that big a deal once it arrives, you know?
Right.
That seems like a nice adoption versus, I mean, if you're going from a state that has, it's totally different and they're just going to adopt next year, I can't imagine how that is going to even work, you know?
Right. Yeah, and no one's doing that as far as I know. I guess where I'll be a little bit more specific, what I'm saying is we've talked about it in previous calls. There are not enough highly qualified earth science, earth system science, whatever you want to call it, high school teachers to implement whatever model you use in order to teach the content in NGSS. They just don't exist in most states. In some states, they're, you know, sort of, but they're going to still need support to get there. You would want to start developing the pre-service programs to really ramping up where those teachers are going to come from, either retraining in-service or pre-service teachers, and that's going to take years for them to show up in the classroom because they have to complete their programs, and new programs are going to have to be developed and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, St. Kitts does teacher professional development. Do they have a certification program for high school or science right now? I don't know. But that's going to take years to get online, right?
Right.
And then teachers go through it and graduate and be, you know, ready to go into the classroom. So 5 years actually doesn't sound like a long time.
Yeah.
This reminds me
well,
of Jason, this really reminds me of his point about modeling instruction and the ability to train teachers just in that approach. And so the transfer from one field to the other is a lot easier. I mean, this is more talking about in-service teachers and encouraging them to use those approaches to be able to feel comfortable talking about earth and space science as opposed to maybe life or physical sciences that they're normally teaching. Are you still on?
Mean, the model that would work really well would be to get a robust set of instructional practices that you could apply for an NSF grant and then scale, do centers, train that cohort of people, refine the materials over a year or two, and then spread with, you know, five centers across the country where you're training other teachers. And you could disseminate stuff pretty quickly. The challenge we're going to face is it always takes you, they argue, about 10 years to get really good at teaching something.
Yeah.
So
yep.
We're talking 15 years before you'd actually have a really, really solid group of materials, teachers, network in place. And I think, in a way, earth sciences has a lot of growth potential. Physics already has pretty well-established communities, and chemistry does. Bio, it's a little more nebulous. But earth science, I don't think, because it hasn't been a priority in a lot of states, just doesn't have that network. The teachers aren't networked as closely,
yep.
And the materials aren't flushed out as much.
Right.
It'd be interesting. I should talk, you know, does anyone here know Tony Murphy?
Yep.
So he's here in town, and their program is really, really, it's a national model for elementary pre-service teaching. It's the National Center for STEM in Elementary Education.
Hmm.
I believe it's one of the only programs in the country that require their elementary teachers to come out of there with a real grounding in science so that they can actually feel comfortable and teach it, which when working with elementary teachers, that's one of the biggest problems. I'd be interested to talk to him just about how they're looking at this. And
Just remember, Kristen, that Tony has moved to be the director of the GLOW program.
Oh, is he gone now?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know he left.
Mm-hmm.
When did that happen?
I don't know officially when it happened.
GLOW was just hosted there.
No. He's now the director at UCAR.
No way. I didn't know that. Our kids were in preschool together for 4 years, and I guess we've been out of preschool for 1 year, and so I
and things changed.
Oh, what a bummer. He was such a great contact.
He still is. GLOW is food.
Well, GLOW is awesome, too, but Case is here in town.
Yeah, I know.
Let's
we'll
see who's over there now.
Yeah, that's a good question, but I think, you know, one of the Jason, your point is I think the how we build that transfer model and that practice, both the pedagogical, the efficiencies of NGSS, assuming that they don't take that 15% new content model. I don't know if you guys caught that piece that Karen Holweg sent, but Achieve is recommending they adopt whole those standards,
mm-hmm.
but there's some clause that they can add 15% content
of their own.
Uh-huh.
And it makes a noisier space.
Yeah.
But the efficiencies of having, you know, 85% same, although it could be 85 different percents, thereby not really, but the efficiencies of having similar standards across a large set of states is kind of allows that field to, you know, improve quicker than because you have so many different states with so many different, you know, focuses and approaches. But I think your point is still the case, is that, you know, how do you build that community of practice across that such large geographic and political boundaries?
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be tricky.
Yeah.
One last point on that is I think you know, this may be where the communities have to come together,
yeah.
who are in the earth and geographic communities, and really figure out a common strategy here. Because if ocean does one thing and climate does another and energy does another and, you know, and atmosphere does another and weather community does another, you know, and it's just, we need focus.
Yeah, that's actually where, you know,
this is Martha.
For a natural place for that. It's not like American Geophysical Union, you know, in some levels is a natural place for it, but education is only really starting to develop there as a major theme. So, we really don't even have the organizational structure to think about this kind of stuff, this strategic notion of how we do this transition and transfer.
I think we had talked about just
a little bit of a communications strategy.
Yeah.
And that might be a fun thing to talk about when we have a presentation about. There seem to be a lot of people within CLN who are interested in communicating tools, and I think it should be. Would that be a separate topic and a separate team? My question. I think, interested in it.
Well, Martha, I think one of the things that the education community really does poorly, and I think Jason alluded to it, is marketing effective strategies and effective resources. And I think especially in this very fertile space, if something's really good, it may take 10 years for people to find out about it.
Yeah,
and we got to cut that. It's a marketing problem in many ways.
Yeah.
How you identify good products is one thing. How do you let people know that this is a good product is a problem that we usually are very poor at. And that's my estimation. I don't know if others agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because good people are looking for stuff. They just need need ways to help streamline that process of getting the good from the overwhelming number of materials out there.
Yeah,
and then they also want to grow themselves, and they want to grow the material base. So involving them in the process of growing it, so that they professionally feel like they can mature through those materials and kind of become a master and maybe a higher level of involvement in developing them.
Right.
Because right now we don't. It's really a horizontal job structure. So nobody really. You come in at pretty much the same level you retire unless you move on to a principalship.
Yeah.
But you have a lot of older teachers who will retire and take the best stuff they have with them, and oftentimes it never gets passed on.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the roles of CLN, isn't it, to be... we're not really librarians, but...
That's kind of what Clean is doing to some degree.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, one of the things I'm funding Clean to do now is to really develop robust marketing strategies.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, even those are going to be, you know, when I see you say robust, they're not going to be robust because we don't have the funding to do robust.
Right.
But at least we're having a better appreciation of how to focus that strategy. How to implement it is another matter yet again.
Yeah.
That's been funded?
I funded it.
Oh, who's this speaking?
That's Frank.
Oh, hi, Frank. Yeah, and we had that really nice presentation last August, and there were a lot of people interested, and we almost did a strategy. You were on that call, but I don't think
there
were only three people on that call.
Yeah. I think post NGSS, you know, finally being adopted or published or whatever you want to call it, this is going to have to be a larger part of our conversation.
I'm really up for that. I love that. It's what I enjoy doing, and I think it's really needed. And I think we have all the talent in the CLN to do it. It's just a matter of organizing. Like I always said, like when I made that presentation, it starts with a strategy and the creative brief. After that, the sky's the limit. Up until that's when that's done, everything just goes around and around. It's like brainstorming without an outcome.
But, Martha, one of the things I think is going to be really interesting to think about is how the education community is different than most communities. And, you know, I don't know if there's a sub-community marketing differentiation strategy. Sorry, that's a bunch of bad words put together. But meaning that, like, as a teacher, you know, I got things different ways than I would have as a citizen. And, you know, how does that work different than other strategies? You know, is there a customized approach to this, and I imagine that's true, but I don't have any inkling on how to approach that.
Yeah.
Well, who are their trusted providers, and how do you?
That's
I assume
different.
That's different in different places.
Yeah.
How do you navigate the system that they work within.
One, and I don't know how we entertain this discussion, but I can tell you amongst most teachers, anybody who's anyone trusts anything from the NSF, they don't trust anything from the generally the U.S. Department of Education, but the problem with NSF funding is it funds novel approaches, and I think NSF could probably play a huge role in really changing STEM ed in the country, but they don't fund sustained efforts. So if you get data and show that you're effective, after 5 or 10 years, your funding runs out, and then everything gets shelved, or maybe it can, like modeling is continuing at the state level, but if you could show demonstrated success, it's sad there's not some other jurisdiction in the federal government or NSF has a small entity for, because education is really a special venture that's a long-term investment in the country that says, this is a great model, we're going to adopt this and we're going to disseminate this nationally, and we're going to keep it going until something else comes along that's better. And that could be 3 or 4 initiatives they do that with, but we don't, STEM ed's so sporadic because once the funding runs out, the program gets shelved and people retire and it's dead. And we've lost a lot of good things that way.
And part of the problem is NSF is conflicted about its role in education.
Yeah.
I've certainly had conversations about this in the last couple of years, is NSF remains very focused on scientific research. And if there's money pulled into education, researchers say, well, that should go to us. This is a research federal agency and not an educational federal agency. But I absolutely agree with Jason. That continuity, that's really the theme of what we've been talking about this whole hour, is how to make sure that all of the good stuff out there is getting into the hands of teachers and maybe their principals and school districts and states, so that we really do focus on this critical thinking and decision making and these techniques.
So Jason, I've actually tried to get NSF to accept this problem, and you're right, they don't. They see it. It's one of those things where it's somebody else's job, but everybody says it's somebody else's job, and thereby it falls between the cracks, and everybody looks at it on the ground and goes, somebody should pick that up. And we tried in many ways, but finding the funding. And one of the things that Mark McCaffrey's summit after AGU was looking at was developing a new funding model for just that thing, which was actually pulling more from the non-governmental funding, more philanthropic or corporate or something like that, where they would keep those initiatives going that are shown promise, merit, and impact, effective impact, or something like that.
Okay.
But that isn't in hand yet.
Yeah,
I mean, just in some ways, convincing them that the teaching community, a lot of the STEM educators really, really trust the NSF. Like they have probably a position of trust and recognition more than most.
Mm-hmm.
That if they could just assume that responsibility, I think the investment would be much more strategic. But I know I'm preaching to the choir, so.
Jason, I would say that on certain topics, NOAA has quite a bit of standing as well. But
yes.
I don't mean to be provincial here.
Yeah. I guess I would put it from the standpoint of broad audience of all science.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If you're talking about Earth, Spain, NASA, NOAA,
Yeah. But the thing about it is that we do carry that, but what we don't carry is the capability. And most of the capability is actually in the grant-funded community that those agencies fund. If NSF funds something, it's the thing that was funded by NSF that actually does the work, not NSF itself. So it's the selection process that NSF does, setting the priorities. And then the project that was done by whomever is really the actual product that teachers are interfacing with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting space, and one of the ideas we had was how to transfer something that was started under, say, NSF, NASA, NOAA, EPA, whatever funding, to a more operational state if it was shown to have value.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the current of that thinking, because scale is going to be really expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But cool.
Yeah.
Scott, I think we just hit our hour.
Yeah, we filled the hour easily.
I guess five of us today, unless some other people are just listening.
Oh, this has been a very great conversation. And I'll talk a little bit with Tamara and see if there's some additional programming we can do to carry this conversation on to a larger group when we do have a presentation. But
yep.
This is really great, guys.
Awesome.
Super. Well, thanks to everyone for participating. We have recorded this, so others will be able to listen to what we were talking about and hope we can add to it.
Okay, everybody.
Thanks for moderating.
Okay, bye now. Thank you.
Thank you, Kit Scott. Thank you all.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.